Listening to KYRS, Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. This is Solidarity Spokane. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and that was This Land Is Your Land by the Avett Brothers. I am joined in the studio today by a very, very old friend of mine named Wyatt. And Wyatt is in here today to talk about the work that he does in hospice care in and around Spokane. But first, we're going to have a brief land acknowledgement. We broadcast acknowledging that we are on the ancestral lands of the Spokane Tribe of Indians and a multitude of tribes who are connected through shared history of trade, celebration, and resources. We make this acknowledgement to pay respects to their elders past and present whose knowledge remains on these lands. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together today. Join our community as we continue to learn about such truths and that we may take direct action with Native people towards restorative justice. Wyatt, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Wyatt, we have been friends for many, many, many years. And in that time, I've heard a lot about the work that you've done for folks. Can you let the folks listening at home know what it is that you do and kind of a little bit about yourself and how you got started?
So I actually got started in the job through my parents both went into the medical field. My mother became a nurse, my sister became a nurse, and then my dad followed suit, became a CNA. Mm-hmm. He ended up falling ill in 2016, and I took care of him at home and realized that the rewarding nature of the job was something to fall in love with, and I couldn't leave. I've been stuck with it ever since.
And so when you first started that job, I mean, it takes a special kind of person, and I know you are that special kind of person who's able to take care and care for somebody who is struggling through one of the most difficult times of their lives. And it's hard on the families. I mean, we both lost our fathers, and so we know what that experience is like. When you first started working in that business, I mean, you knew what you were walking into.
Not exactly. I was more expecting less hands-on stuff. Like, I knew the nitty-gritty of the job, and I knew that there's things that you would do that would kind of make this a more squeamish person react negatively, but it ended up being something that was a big shock to walk into, more so than what I was expecting.
Yeah. I mean, so day one, I mean, were you nervous on your first? I mean, we're all nervous for like a first job and all that, but was it amplified? I feel like I would just be a shaky mess.
Oh yeah, I was a nervous wreck, especially because it's not like having an animal at home or anything like that, where you have to take care of something that is rewarding but can't tell you when you're doing something wrong or can't be disgruntled with you. People are people, and taking care of people it's a hard job because everybody's got an opinion.
An opinion, and sometimes even though you're doing the best that you possibly could do for a person, and you know it is, maybe they don't see it that way and
right.
Might have some choice words for you.
Absolutely. Everybody has their own standards.
Does anything stand out in your mind from that first couple of weeks that maybe made you second guess your choice or maybe made you think, gosh, I really hadn't thought about it in this way?
The first death that I had seen still sticks with me today, and it was over 8 years ago. And that one, it was just a really surreal experience because your brain doesn't want to see somebody that has passed on. It just doesn't. So you almost see them breathing still, and just it's like a psychological flip. You just don't expect to see something like that on a regular day-to-day basis. And in facilities like that, it's pretty regular.
Right. And so your brain is kind of trying to compensate for the trauma of what it's experiencing, and we're kind of hardwired, especially because we're not in proximity to death in ways that we might have been in the past.
Right.
I don't want to say that we outsource it, but we, you know, death and dying had a place in the home up until probably about the mid-20th century when people started going into care facilities when they were receiving end-of-life care.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And up until, I would say just recently, the last 20 years, they didn't really have laws in place to protect those people that were put in facilities like that. So that's why there's so many rules and regulations with those facilities now, is because at some point or another, those laws were broken.
Surely, Wyatt, you can't be telling me that there are rules and regulations that actually do the public any good.
I mean, there are, but a lot of them just seem inconvenient because it's something that somebody who shouldn't be working in the field has done before.
And we've learned through trial and error because people have been hurt,
right,
and damaged. And so that's where those regulations come from.
Absolutely.
I feel there's always a really popular vein in media to slander regulations because everybody's just trying to get from A to B. But there are many that are there because of hard learned lessons that thankfully we have not had to experience firsthand.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I'm wondering, and I wanted to ask you, are we doing our elders justice? Do you believe that the system, as it's working now, is allowing people dignity in their final hours?
That's such a hard question to answer because I feel like personally it's from place to place and it depends on management and staff. And I've just worked with so many different walks of life working for helping people that I've seen all ends of the spectrum where people actually genuinely want to help these people and give them dignity and improve their life at least a little bit while they're still here. And then there's people that seem like they're there for more selfish reasons, just because it's money or it's a lot of hours, because the industry is struggling for staff right now.
Can we talk about that?
Sure.
I know that in the nursing profession, nurses have spoken about the fact that they can't give adequate care when they're understaffed. Have you felt that at facilities that you may have worked at in the past?
Yeah, I would definitely say that that was a big reason for me leaving one of the first ones that I'd worked at, just because my last week there, I showed up and I was one of the only caregivers to show up.
Out of a regular staff of how many?
Six people that were supposed to be there, and I was one person that showed up until like 8 in the morning.
How many patients were you taking care of?
That day was like 64 for the first 2 hours, which isn't possible.
Not possible at all, but you were still expected to show up and try.
I tried. Oh, you better believe I tried.
What happens when you're in a situation like that? I mean, despite the fact that you are feeling an incredible amount of pressure, how does that carry over into the patient's experience?
So the best thing that I personally feel like I can do is get everybody that I know is in the building involved. So a lot of people don't realize, but management and facilities like that, a lot of the time can help with like patient care and just stuff like that, just little things, which the aides I feel like are spread pretty far thin, because they're in Washington State, I believe the ratio is 1 to 13. So you can take care of 13 patients, and those patients can be like full cares, to where you use mechanical lifts to get them in and out of bed. You dress them, you bathe them, you do their hair, brush their teeth, feed them, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that can be really time consuming. And if you have 13 people that you're supposed to get up and ready for breakfast at 7, you get there at 6, you better be moving.
Did you have to do that routine for 13 people in about 2 hours?
For about 7 years, I did that.
And 64 is just not realistically going to happen.
Yeah, there's a reason why they made the legal cap 13, is because it's like borderline breaking labor laws of just like overworking their staff. Like, medical staff in general is known to be run kind of rampant, just because you never know when a medical anomaly is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But that always leaves that, like, you're always left that room for error.
Mm-hmm. Have you experienced instances where you felt like perhaps you were understaffed intentionally, or there wasn't adequate attention being paid to the staffing?
Yeah, never did I ever feel like it was an intentional thing, like somebody was trying to say they didn't want to staff the building a certain way a certain day. But I definitely feel like there were ways or days where we would call and ask for staff because we were short. And instead of doing that, we would be moved to other units or other buildings. And that stuff is also really stressful, because in nursing, they like to have continuity of care. So you mm-hmm. get to know your patients, you stay in that general section, and you take care of those residents primarily, and that helps them also get to know you, and so they trust when they see you that they're going to get good cares. So when you're moved to another area of the building and you have all these residents that see you that don't know you, first off, being a man in medical, it's different, because a lot of little old ladies are scared of you. It just happens that way.
I'd be scared of me too.
I mean, I'm not a little guy either, so I walk into a room and it's intimidating to see a bearded man walk into a room saying, like, I have to change you.
In a low voice.
Right. Yeah. It's just one of those things that not everybody's going to be receptive of that.
Absolutely.
And so, like, I've had some really crazy accusations. I've had to be investigated. Like, there's been a lot of, like, turmoil in that job. Mm-hmm. But it's still so worth it, because I know where my heart's at and I know what my intentions are. And finding that in this field, it's not like it's difficult, but finding it in this field is rare. you don't really find people, like, you find people that want to care for the residents that are there, but at the same time, people also get burnt out, and there's always, like, staff issues with one another, and just stuff that pops up.
And that burnout, I guess I'm wondering, there are some jobs that it's just so hard to accommodate that, for the burnout. And so I think, like, a lot of what workers are trying to do is find an equal balance where they're trying to tell management, hey, this is what we can do, you know, to keep up with the work that's being demanded of us. And that's unique and specific to each kind of job. Have you seen things that contribute to burnout at a higher rate of people that you've worked with where you're like, this was their breaking point consistently?
So being somebody who has always cared for the residents that I've taken care of, I've actually experienced personal burnout just through, I am a very kind natured person. And so if I see somebody who's like in a mess, I'm just going to take care of it. I'm not going to go find the staff member to do it because that takes time. Mm-hmm. And somebody in a mess obviously doesn't want to sit that way. So right. I was always the type of person to like take over and kind of take care of that because they deserve that. Mm-hmm. But that in some places has been taken advantage of to where people just leave certain people because they don't want to deal with the type of personality or attitude that they have. And I got really good at that. Like I got really good at dealing with residents that were more difficult because they could trust me. They knew that I was reliable.
How do you approach somebody that is going through, because there are obviously physical concerns that a patient might experience, but there's always also mental, co-occurring mental things that could be happening. So,
sure.
I mean, if a patient is being that way to you, I mean, what do you find is the most, you know, effective way to de-arm that situation and kind of win that trust? Because I feel like that there's winning trust and then there's, you know, establishing and nurturing it. So...
Sure. So in facilities that are usually skilled nursing, there's a lot of residents that live there with dementia and Alzheimer's, and that's why they're in a skilled facility, because they need extra help instead of like an assisted living, for instance, where a lot of the residents there just kind of have like an apartment, and they have usually help with like medications, but they can come and go as they please. They can go out and like eat dinner and stuff. While in skilled nursing, a lot of the time they have what they call wander guards on these residents, to where if they leave the building, alarms go off. And it's not like they're allowed to restrain them or withhold them in the building, but it's dangerous for them to be outside because mm-hmm. they'll walk out into traffic and do because they just don't understand what's going on a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And so they can put themselves in some pretty dangerous situations.
Yeah. And if you're experiencing somebody who is not compliant, who is, you know, I worked very briefly in elder care when I was younger, and I was definitely too young. Like I hopped on that when I was 18, 19, because yeah. my mom was in the business. And so I tried my hand at it and realized quickly that I did not have my chops yet. Let's sure. put it that way.
Yeah, there's been a few situations that I've personally been in that I wasn't exactly sure how to de-escalate it. And the best thing that I've learned to do is to just redirect somebody like that, redirect their energy, or just suggest something else. A lot of the time, if they have family pictures, you can ask them what they are, and then they'll like change the subject, go on to something else. A lot of the time when somebody's being combative or upset with you, it's for a reason that you can't really fix. And so the best thing you can do is just apologize profusely, let them know that you're going to do your best to fix it. Because that's all you can do, especially if it's an issue that's out of your hands.
Yeah. How do you build that armor? I know that there are times when I'm working with clients in my line of work where there are direct personal attacks, or at least not, it's hard not to feel like that's personal, you know, or that, and you know, it's not, but there is a point where they can get up and under the arm plate there and kind of get you.
Oh yeah. There's definitely been personal attacks against my character or my sexuality. And, it's one of those things that you just got to take with a grain of salt, because a lot of the people that you're taking care of are from a different generation. They were raised completely differently than what we were. Mm-hmm. So to be raised like I was with an open mind, I find myself to be very grateful for that, I definitely feel bad for a little bit of the closed-mindedness that comes with some older ideals and views, but that's just it. Is it was something that was taught to them by an older generation that wasn't as open and informed.
And we've got about, actually, we are right at break. So that was a very well-timed response, Wyatt. Thank you so much. So we are just going to go to a quick break, a quick message, and we're going to be right back. Valley,
this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my.
Featuring LGBTQ folk, friends, allies, and all who make Spokane a better place through inclusion, creativity, truth, and beauty. Local stories, conversations, and creations with universal appeal. Out and About, every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on KYRS.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for July 31st through August 3rd. Monday, Rosie Sircone at Brick West and Open Mic hosted by Lucas Brookbank Brown at the Red Room. Tuesday, Nick Groh at Riverfront Eats, Nate Ostrander at Twigs, Dallas K at True Legends, Calliope at the Rocket Market, and Arlo McKinley and Justin Wells at Lucky U Lounge. Wednesday, Jovi and the Honey Chuckle at Beck's Harvest House, Sonny Sweeney and Aaron Enderlin at The District, High Viz and Pitt at Lucky U Lounge, Riley Anderson at Iron Horse in the Valley, Open Mic at the Checkerboard, and The Roommates Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, B at Magnolia American Brasserie, Kyle Richard and Friends at Brick West, Suhanna Jens at Rocky Hill Park, Ron Green at Craft and Gather, Jerry Lee Rains at True Legends, London Get Down at Brick West, the Jared Hall Quartet at Emma Roo's, Bob Love at the Checkerboard, and the Steel Drivers at the Fox. For an entire hour of Spokane area musicians, tune into For the Love of the Music every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
Hi, this is Jeremy Whittington from Stage Left Theater. KYRS Thin Air Community Radio provides our region with information that might be omitted, overlooked, or even censored by mainstream media. Your radio station is powered by the communities they serve, and our radio programs are as rich and diverse as the Spokane community itself. Please make a pledge today by texting GIVE KYRS to 44321. Your support ensures that KYRS can continue to celebrate the rich diversity of our community.
The mission of Planned Parenthood is to ensure all people have access to the care and resources they need to make informed decisions about their bodies, their lives, and their futures. Each year, Planned Parenthood delivers vital reproductive health care, sex education, and information to millions of people in the United States and around the world. Information online at PlannedParenthood.org. Welcome back from the break. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and I am here with my old friend Wyatt, and we are discussing his work in hospice care and elder care services. It's really good to have you on, Wyatt. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about that generational divide that you experienced with some of your residents, and I want to circle back to that before we move on to any other questions, because there is this debate among the left, and I've had it with folks, and we will continue to have it about, you know, I think they call it the elder pass, where someone might do something, but because of their advanced age, we kind of might turn the other way or just not choose to engage it because of their advanced age. And then there's the question of where do you draw that line? You know, obviously, if somebody is in a mental facility for issues with dementia or anything like that, you're going to give a lot of leeway. But do you have anything to say about that generational divide and like what you've learned working with folks who are three times our age?
It's actually kind of funny. I've worked with all walks of life, and I've taken care of all sorts of different people. I've taken care of cleric nuns and priests, and it's really interesting when you have these people that have been raised a certain way and eventually learn that they don't have to live by a certain demographic. They get to kind of carve their own path. I had this lady that I had taken care of, and she was in her 60s. She was a cleric nun, and she came out of the closet as lesbian to me. Because I would just talk about how open I was and my partner and I at the time, and she ended up soaking that up and realizing that it was kind of like a judge-free zone, and she felt safe. So I went out and I bought her a lesbian pride flag and hung it up on her wall, and she was happy as a clam.
That is so cool. I mean, so she had never opened up about that before?
No, she'd never told anybody.
Was this towards the end of their life?
She's actually still around.
That's great.
Yeah, she's actually still around. I send her letters every now and then. Total sweetheart. One of the coolest people I think I've not only ever met, but just had conversations with, and extremely educated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that lady read articles and books, and at the time I was in a relationship with somebody who was non-binary, and she approached me with this entire stack of articles of two-spirited people that were that come from Native culture. So basically, it's been something that's been around for a long time, and so she kind of like dug up the info and was just like, "Well, this is where that comes from," and kind of showed me that it's been around for a while. So for people to teach it as such or to think of it as such taboo now is such a weird thing when it was around before we even got here.
Mm-hmm. I've asked this question a little bit before, but I mean, on the one hand, you have folks like that who are rad and you know, are on you the
also,
level.
You also get the other side, sure. And that's one thing in medical facilities is a lot of the time when you're dealing with people that have these medical anomalies or have been through physical trauma to where they can't do a lot of things on their own anymore, they sort of get the pass from me just because I can't imagine how upsetting it would be to my flow of life if I had some sort of injury that put me in a place where my choices were limited and everybody made those decisions for me. That would be something that I would be probably really depressed about. So I can only imagine what these residents go through that are like just upset with life. I can only imagine. It's got to be a real big reality check for a lot of the people that get put in facilities like that. In general public, it's a little bit different. I'm not the type of person to hold my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody were to come at me for what I wear, which is usually pretty out there, or my sexuality.
It always looks good.
Hey, yeah, I appreciate that. But I, you know, like in those types of situations, I would be somebody who would correct somebody or would tell them like, hey, that's pretty not okay to say. Or I would kind
and
of.
Not so many words.
Right. Or in those types of situations, it's best to flip the mirror on them. So to kind of show them, like, what would you think if I judged you for being the way that you were?
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't think that would be cool if I judge you for being old or, you know, anything like that. Like, it would be seen as something upsetting to most people.
Any one of those intersectional identities.
Right.
That, you know, define us.
And I feel like that goes both ways.
Uh-huh.
Like, you don't want to be judging old people, just like old people don't want to be judged for, let's say, like, being slow drivers. Like, that's a stereotype of older drivers that, like, you know, it's used a lot as, like, a derogatory thing.
I wanna just tell a quick anecdote about my great-grandmother, Blanche.
Sure.
Because this woman, at 80 years old, was driving an old, I think it was a Lincoln or a T-Bird, but it was a long car. It was the length of a hearse, you know, and she got pulled over for doing like 50 in a school zone, and the cop tried to put his foot on her bumper, and you know, it's small town, everybody knew everybody. I think his name was Wade, and she said, "Wade, get your foot off my bumper, I'll run you over." So no, that stereotype does not hold true, and it definitely does not hold true in my family. My grandmother just four-wheeled over a curb the other day in Walmart a couple months ago. So Yeah, no, the stereotypes that we often have in our minds are not true. So beware lest you be taken down by the spirit of my great-grandmother Blanche.
There you go.
And all her fury. But we were talking a little bit, too, when I asked you to come on the show, a little bit on a more serious note about the trauma that you've experienced in your life and how that led you to this place and the work that you do and how you confront that every day at work.
Sure.
And, you know, you willingly make that choice to go into that place, to do the work that you do, and it's incredibly valuable to our community. Do you think that there are better ways that we can take care of our service professionals that are working in these environments where they encounter death and they encounter these heavy experiences? Because it's not like you just clock off after losing a resident you've worked with for several months and just go home and snap right out of it, you know?
Yeah, I've been a really big advocate for medical facilities like that to have like a retainer for their staff to be able to go see like a counselor or a therapist, especially because you do get close to these people that you take care of. For instance, I was working on Friday taking care of this lady who I had to send out to the ER, and she passed away a couple hours later while she was there.
And you were just talking to her that day. Things were fine.
Yeah, the last words I said to her was, "I hope you feel better. I'll see you soon." It's those types of situations are never expected, unless somebody is like on hospice. They've stopped eating or drinking. Mm-hmm. There's situations like that, but
which you've worked in more extensively in the past. You worked in dedicated hospice facilities, and
So I worked with people who are at end of life care, which is a completely different thing. In end of life care, it's more so focused on just making them as comfortable as possible because they are in that position because they're going to pass away. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. And so the best thing that you can do is just make sure that they're as comfortable as possible. And that was something that I really enjoyed just because it was really rewarding. And it's not like the person that you're taking care of can really thank you, but people around them and family usually are really grateful for providing good cares for people because, of course, they want to see their family member taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, do you believe that it's come across sometimes where you wonder, you're a passive observer, so you can't really get in the middle, but have you ever had a resident who wanted their family to be there that wasn't or that didn't?
Sadly, that happens quite often in the facilities that I've been in. There's a lot of family that drop off their loved one because they can't take care of it anymore. It's become too much of a physical and mental strain on them. And they get to the point where they put them in a nursing home. And it's like almost like a relief for some people, which I don't necessarily understand, but I also lost my dad at a much younger age than I feel like I should have. And so I kind of felt robbed of time with my family.
Right.
So when I see that kind of thing happen, I don't necessarily understand it. But then again, I was really lucky to have the relationship with my parents that I did.
Mm-hmm. Your parents are incredible people.
Yeah.
Your dad was an incredible man.
Yeah, he was.
Your mom is an incredible woman.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, and they raised an incredible son.
Hey, appreciate that.
No problem. What would you say to somebody that wanted to do this? That was thinking, I think there are a lot of people, and I've been close to a lot of them, who have been formed by their experiences with trauma and with their loss, and they want to give back because there's something very empowering about being able to take that experience that breaks some people and molding something creative and useful with it, and then turning and giving that back to the community. For anyone that might be listening, what would you say to them?
So there's a common misconception that because nursing is so short-staffed, that's what that sort of thing needs is more staff. But I think at least personally, something that would be really cool to the residents if they just had like a crew of people walk through and just say, what do you want for Christmas? That alone, just that alone, would brighten so many people's hearts. It would be insane. Because I've worked in facilities where they've handed around bags of candy and told the residents that there's going to be a lot of trick-or-treaters, and then they'll bring a whole gang of kids through and they'll go trick-or-treating to these residents, and you can just see them light up. It's just an experience that they haven't had in such a long time. And I remember when I was working in skilled nursing, you'd ask some of these residents, what do they want for Christmas? What do they want for this? What do they want for that? Some of them just said a couple avocados.
A couple avocados.
A pair of socks. A scarf. A beanie. Something an electric toothbrush. Just something. Little things like that. People don't realize how much of an impact it has because medical is so regulated that they get all these shipments of stuff that come in, and it's all like the same brand of toothpaste, toothbrushes, deodorant, shaving cream, all this stuff. And it's to them, I could see how it feels like they're lacking a little bit of variety in their lives. And so having just like fresh fruit or something brought into them really brightens a person's day.
And it seems not only that, but also if you have those kinds of human comforts, it seems like, and I'm not a scientist or a doctor, I have no statistics to back this up, but I would encourage anybody to Google it and tell me if I'm right or wrong. But it seems like the health outcomes for patients would improve the more they were exposed to those kinds of stimuli.
Absolutely. So, for instance, I'm working with somebody who does like a Zumba class, and she's gotten residents up and moving, and she's gotten some residents like to lose 20, 30 pounds just because they have found motivation in going to Zumba class. And so they go to this class and they go dance around, do Zumba, and it's like a great motivator for them. Instead of being like sedentary and just kind of waiting around for the next thing to happen, it's really nice for these people to have these activities that they can go and experience that they wouldn't usually be able to because they use equipment and stuff like that to move around with.
Yeah. Do you think, like, as a culture, that we're obsessed with being young and that the idea of becoming old and everything that comes with that is almost a fate worse than dying? Do you think that we do our elders a disservice because, I mean, we are in an interesting political environment where older folks tend to be more aligned with a more conservative mindset, and there are clearly things in our society that we're not addressing and that do need to change. And so I feel like this is getting tied up a little bit in our empathy and our compassion for our older citizens. What do you think?
I would absolutely agree with that to a certain extent. There's a lot of people who work in healthcare that put that to the side. Mm-hmm. So I don't care what your religion is, what sexuality you are, race, anything like that.
Who you voted for.
I don't care. I don't care. It has nothing to do with my ability to make sure that you are comfortable and you're well taken care of. That's a completely different thing. Now, if we met on the outside of a nursing facility that I didn't work in and you had a conversation with me about how gay people were the worst, yeah, we're going to have an issue.
Yeah, there's going to be a concern there.
Sure.
Okay. We are speaking with Wyatt, a good old friend of mine from many, many years, and he's speaking to us about the work that he does in skilled nursing facilities and in hospice care. We're going to take a quick break, a couple more messages, and we'll be right back. Me.
Saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with darkness and strife.
Hi, I'm Julia, and I like dragonflies because I love learning new facts and information every week. Tune in to Dragonflies on Thin Air every Sunday at 3 on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and
92.3 FM. KYRS wants your brand new car! Well, not really. Yes, indeed, it's a great feeling to finally get another car after the old one's been breaking down over and over. It's another great feeling to get even more use out of an old car. Here's how. Donate it to KYRS. Car donors get a membership, a tax deduction, and the satisfaction of really helping out. Just call toll-free 855-KYRS-CAR. That's 855-597-7227. Honk, honk!
When I say our breaks are quick, I really do mean they are quick. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, the show built by workers for workers. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and I'm joined with my old friend Wyatt here in the studio talking about their work in CNA skilled nursing facilities and in the past hospice care. And I'm just going to pop in real quick to remind all of the folks there at home that this is your hour. If you're listening to this show and you have work that you are doing in the community that you feel needs recognition, if you know an organization that you believe fosters solidarity and community, if you have a neighbor that you love and you want to bring on air and talk about all of the beautiful, wonderful things that that light of a human being is doing for their community and their neighborhood, please send me an email at solidaritiespokane@kyrs.org, and I would be happy to hear your stories and give you time in my seat, because this is your community radio station, and I built this hour specifically so that we can hear more of the marginalized voices of workers who don't get the recognition for the very critical, and some have said, essential work that you do to keep this economy running. This is a reminder that we're going to spend 90,000 hours, on average, hours of our lives at work. And we got to make them count. And I want that time to be heard on air for you. So send me an email, solidaritiespokane@kyrs.org. Even if you just want to tell me what you would like me to change, because I'm not perfect. I'm not on a pedestal. There's plenty of stuff that I could do better every single day. So I'm anxious to hear from you. SolidaritySpokane@KYRS.org. And Wyatt, we've got about 14 minutes left.
All right.
To fill the hour. And some of the things that I wanted to ask you about, we've gotten to cover.
Sure.
And some of the things we have not. I think that the most important thing that we should talk about again is the stories of folks that you have worked with. Now, there are, of course, regulations around that, so we're not going to use names or identifying personal information.
Right.
But are there any stories that stand out to you that you believe mattered to you or have significance in your heart that you carry with you?
I think the first story that comes to mind as far as my ability to help somebody and how rewarding it was, and just my relationship with the person that I had before I had helped them.
Yeah.
It was a lady who had come in after she had a massive stroke. She couldn't really speak. She couldn't really move all too well. She was paralyzed on one side. And she ended up, for whatever reason, I was the person that she looked forward to, because I'd just get to her whenever she wanted. And there's something about somebody who has a really good sense of humor. It makes it a lot easier to take care of them, because you can just give them a really hard time and they love it.
Yeah.
And they love it, because nobody does that. Nobody in healthcare is going to be like, oh man, I don't want to do that for you. And then they're just like smile at you and do it anyways. And like that, for some reason, a lot of people are afraid to have a resident like snap back at them. And it's like, I kind of take that risk of if you do say something like that, you could offend somebody.
But you do kind of put yourself out on that plank,
right?
Or that branch, rather.
Sure. Yeah. But at the same time, if it lands, that resident's going to be like, oh my gosh, this person sees me as a person, not just something like somebody to take care of or like a task that they have to do. And like joking around with somebody is one of the easiest forms of communication.
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to like have regular human interaction with people that probably don't have it all that often because it's just a medical setting where these people get the, you know, the regular same interactions with the same people that they have every day.
Mm-hmm.
So to have somebody that comes in and flips the script on them and tells them that they stink one day or, you know, just something crazy. I mean, not like that, but just like specifically telling somebody, like they ask you a question like, hey, could you pick that up off the floor? And you're like, I don't know. You've asked me for enough today. Like they get a kick out of that.
Yeah.
So those types of situations are really rewarding. But as I was saying, this lady that I had this really good relationship with, there was one day where I was just walking down the hallway and I heard what sounded like a scream or like, you know, something. I couldn't quite make it out. Right.
Yeah.
A human sound that you don't want to be hearing. And so I ran into her room and she was choking. And so she was wheelchair bound. So I just wrapped around her wheelchair and did the Heimlich and saved this lady's life right then and there. Didn't, like, still to this day, I think about her because that was definitely the first time where I had to, like, act on instinct without any sort of direction. And they were just like, no, you have to do this. Like, mm-hmm. You just have to do it.
Pulse increases. Yeah,
I was sweating so bad. Probably one of the most scary situations of that career in that building as well.
You highlight so wonderfully, as you do to all who know you, but of the healing power of laughter.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, my dad had colon cancer, and he got 6 months when he got his initial diagnosis in 2010. And that man could make he could make a miserable Roman statue like bust up with laughter. I mean, he would go through the like drive-through and do voices that may or may not be appropriate anymore. And, you know, just have the people on the other end just rolling.
Sure.
And he ended up living 7.5 years. And I still to this day know that that's because he was a laugher and he was a joker and could give that and receive it from wherever he could find it.
Sure.
And, you know, that's a really wonderful thing that you highlight about being able to give that to folks.
Sure. When they say that laughter is really the best medicine, they're not lying. Laughter and that release of serotonin and dopamine, even though it's not just that, like being able to connect with people when you don't have those connections on a regular basis is important.
Mm-hmm. And we've all seen, you know, what happens when you neglect that, even for yourself.
Sure.
I mean, but then to willfully, you know, subject individuals to it because they're in an institution is a truly terrifying idea.
Absolutely.
That you could end up somewhere where nobody is thinking about that.
Right.
In your interest, or that you are just, and I mean, we live in a relatively good state.
Absolutely.
I just want to give it up for Washington because we have relatively good regulations and human care. We passed the Right to Die Act.
Yep.
So now if you have a terminal illness, you do not have to, you know, languish until the end. And we have some really humane legislation that is crafted to protect people from those things. But I mean, that is far from the case in some other states where
absolutely,
I mean, incidents of elder abuse are increased. I mean, and these are all in states that have lax regulations.
Right.
You know.
You need to have very strict regulations and rules and laws. And like, there's weird things about nursing homes that you wouldn't necessarily don't make a whole lot of sense unless you've worked in the field for a long time. So one of the things that really shocked me was I saw it on a kitchen slip. And on this person's kitchen slip, it said no tubular meats, which means hot dogs, The person couldn't eat hot dogs because they didn't have like the chewing or swallowing capability to do it. But tubular meats was the thing that they chose because it was literally all of the like Vienna sausages and everything you could think of.
Yeah, because you can't just say hot dogs. You have to be as general.
But you can imagine reading that on a piece of paper when you're trying to like give somebody their meal was shocking to say the least.
I think I might start a band.
I've thought about it. That would have been the name for it, for sure.
You bass. I'll play banjo or something.
All right.
Tubular meats coming to the airwaves near you.
That's it. 2025, expect it.
Yeah. Expected, but not promised.
You're right.
And certainly not on during mealtime.
Right, but, absolutely.
I'm really, really grateful that you have taken the time to come on the air and, you know, and talk about these things. Because they're not easy issues to discuss.
Sure.
And they have a lot of implications for all of us as we plan our end of life care.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where are we going to end up? What's going to happen to us? I mean, I know that for myself, my experience with the passing of my father taught me that I dreaded the idea of ending up in a bed, or anything like that, because it was not a humane thing that happened to him. I mean, he got to a point where the doctor just said, we are going to dehydrate and stop giving him anything, and then his body will do what it does naturally. And I still cannot fathom in my mind, and I still run it over why that there is not a way for us to help our loved ones in that situation when we could do it for a family pet or, you know, anything in that similar situation.
That is a sticky situation, that one, because with people, we have our own free will.
Mm-hmm.
And comparative to animals, in the United States, animals are seen as property.
Mm-hmm.
So once you buy a dog, that's your property. It's not your dog. It's your property, which I still find that is weird because obviously my dog is my baby.
Would you call your dog your pupperty?
Yeah, absolutely.
But shout out to Banjo sitting at home listening.
Oh yeah, he's probably sitting on the couch. But the whole thing about giving somebody that option to end things before it happens naturally, I feel like is important, but because it's something that's so new to the United States as a whole, we don't have the information to be able to just allow people to do it if they become ill in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of guidelines. There's going to be a lot of regulations and rules and laws that come out to be able to make sure that people can't just decide that they're done with life and end it.
I'm happy that we're moving in that direction and that we're able to explore those regulations because it does take time and concerted effort. Sometimes I think folks will look at a regulation, they'll throw it together haphazardly and say, you know, we built it and it's faulty. There are holes in it. It does not work. It must be dismantled.
Yeah.
However, it is a process that takes time.
Right.
And effort.
If you look at nursing homes, when they first came out, it was pretty bad. Like there was a reason why we have all these laws to protect the residents from abuse. And it's because it happened so much. And so now that these laws are in place to protect these people, it's going to be the same thing with people who are at like end of life care or to be able to make that decision for themselves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if somebody doesn't have the mental capacity, that's going to be a really weird, sticky situation. Do they ask family or do they ask the power of attorney? Does the person have a power of attorney? There's a lot of questions to be able to ask about that. So I do agree with you. I do feel like we're still behind in that regard. But we're moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And nobody can be as advanced as the Swiss are in this regard. But I think we've got 1 minute left, and I know I've been specifically warned not to go over time. So unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But
sure.
Wyatt, it has been a pleasure having you. And thank you so much for your humility, your laughter, and as always, for being just one of the biggest, brightest human beings that I know.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Wyatt. And remember, if you have a story that you believe is worth telling, if you have a community organization that you believe is fostering solidarity in the community and you would like to promote them or have them come on the show and speak about the work that they're doing to make this community better, I shouldn't use the word promote, not promote, but if you would like to come on the air and have a conversation about what they do and how that is making our community better, please, please do send me an email at solidaritiespokane@kyrs.org. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage. That's it. Until next week.
Democracy Now! Receives support from Chaz Health, serving the Inland Northwest with 13 clinics offering medical, dental, behavioral health, and pharmacy services to families and individuals of all ages. More information at 509-444-8200 and online at chaz.org.
Thin Air Community Radio receives support from the Root Experience Festival, a two-night BIPOC-centered art, music, and film festival celebrating regional filmmakers, artists, dancers, culture bearers, musicians, and the intergenerational stories they weave through their art. August 26th and 27th at the Spokane Central Library and the Magic Lantern Theater. Information online at therootexperience.org.
KYRS, Medical Lake, Spokane.
The following program was pre-recorded.
New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is entrapment. You are sending informant into a impoverished community, the most impoverished county, to do your trickery. You ain't stumbled upon a cell. Nobody ain't tell you that someone was plotting to do anything. You created a crime.
For the past 14 years, relatives of four men jailed on terrorism charges in Newburgh, New York, have accused the FBI of entrapment. On Thursday, a federal judge agreed and ordered the release of three of the men. In a stunning decision, the judge accused the FBI of inventing a conspiracy. We'll speak to two attorneys who spent over a decade trying to win the freedom of the Newburgh Four. Then, a former OBGYN at Columbia University, Robert Haddon, has been sentenced to 20 years in a federal prison. He's accused of sexually assaulting hundreds of patients during examinations over two decades. We'll speak to two survivors and look at why Columbia ignored Haddon's behavior for so long.
I was the first person to speak publicly about being sexually assaulted by Robert Haddon, including when I was pregnant with my twin daughters. I was fortunate to be in court last week to watch the sentencing in his federal trial. It is certainly a milestone in what has been a many years-long quest for justice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, at least 54 people were killed, 200 injured Sunday as explosions rocked a political rally in the northwestern Bajor district, which borders Afghanistan. The deadly blast was triggered by a suicide bomber during a gathering of the conservative Jamiat Ulema Ismail Faisal party, which is part of Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's ruling coalition. The bombing came amidst mounting insecurity ahead of elections planned for November.